You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
In yesterday's Wire, Christina spoke to Viviana Becker from the University of Auckland about the rejection of the Chilean constitutional reforms and what it means politically and for the people of Chile. For a legal view of the referendum and what comes next, I chatted to constitutional lawyer Joel Colon Rios in Santiago and started by asking what is wrong with Chile's current constitution that demands change.
Yes, well, the main problem, if you can call it a problem, and it is a big problem, is that the constitution of 1980, which is the current constitution in Chile, was the product of a dictatorship. That is to say, it was the constitution adopted during the dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet. And when the country returned to democracy after 1990, there was no new constitution making process. Instead, the constitution was reformed in some ways, and then the constitution was reformed again later on in 2005 in order to remove some of the most authoritarian elements that characterized it. But still today, many Chileans, and this is not something new, this is something that has been in Chilean political and constitutional discussions for a long time, is the fact that even if you remove some of the most problematic elements of the constitution of 1980, it is still a constitution created by a dictatorship, and every country, every democratic country, the idea would say should have a democratically adopted constitution.
So what was it about the proposed constitution that the majority of Chileans didn't like? Was it some of the principles? Was it the negotiation process itself? What made people reject it?
Yes, well, that's people in Chile, and right now I am talking from Santiago, they are still wondering precisely about that. No one knows exactly what happened, what were the main reasons for the result in the referendum. So perhaps it's worth to just very briefly talk about the origins of this constitution making process. So in 2019, there were a number of protests and massive demonstrations in Chile that were not really at the beginning about having a new constitution, but they were about having better healthcare, having better public transportation, and just people generally unhappy with political parties and unhappy with the government, which at that time was a conservative government. And at some point, no one really knows why, those demands about different things, healthcare, public transportation, education, and so on, they started to come together into a call for a new constitution. Now, one of the reasons it had been quite difficult in Chile to adopt a new constitution, even after the return to democracy, was that one of the things that the creators of the constitution of 1980 did was that they made sure that any constitutional change would have to be consented by the very forces that brought the constitution into existence, even after the return to democracy, right? So the constitution was, for example, very difficult to change, which meant that it required a very broad majority in order to change it, and that meant that you needed the support of the most conservative elements of the Chilean legislature, which were still supportive of the constitution of 1980. But the protests of 2019 and the public demand for a new constitution was so big that this involved violence, but also involved passive and massive public demonstrations. The result was that the political parties, even the conservative ones, they realized that there was no other option. They had to come into an agreement to create a new constitution. And the according to that agreement, that was eventually formalized into a different process, through a different process, a special assembly would be convened. And that special assembly will be comprised of elected candidates. Now, the political parties thought that the candidates who would be elected to that assembly would be members of the political parties, right? So they thought that, you know, they would basically control the assembly and would be able to adopt a new constitution that was sort of consistent with the status quo to a certain extent. But what happened was, and no one expected this, that the majority of the members of the assembly who were elected were independents, people that had no connections to the political parties, some which were came from social movements, sometimes left-wing radical social movements. And the political parties only controlled maybe 20 of, or, you know, there was a group of parties say that they would control 25 seats of the 155 in the assembly. Another group of political parties would control 20 and so on, but there were in total more than 100 independents, some of which just ran as independents, others ran as under a political party, but with no previous connection to the parties. So then what happened was that the convention started to operate and the in a very sort of non-traditional way. And there were a number of things during the process that you know, I don't know what the word to describe them would be, but they were just sort of mini scandals, if you wish, about, you know, embarrassing things that one member of the assembly or the other did. And, you know, there was a lot of pressure from the and criticism from the traditional political parties, from the media. So a situation began to develop, I think, where the assembly sort of, even though it was quite a democratic entity, one of the things that characterized it was that according to the rules of its election, it had to be, there had to be gender parity in the assembly, so there had to be the same number of men and women. Or at least 155 members, or at least you know, there could be a difference of one, but it had to be basic gender parity. Plus, there were 17 seats for the indigenous peoples of Chile. Chile has you know, the Mapuches, who are the largest indigenous group, but it has also 7 or 8 or 9 more indigenous groups. So they had 17 seats. So it was a very democratic entity, but I think, and this is something that there seems to be general agreement here, that the assembly at some point began to operate in a way that sort of disconnected itself from the general electorate. And the constitution it produced, it's I would describe it as a very progressive constitution, but was a constitution that, after it was formally presented to the by the convention, so the convention formally presented the text they had written, and then the convention dissolved until the referendum, which took place a couple of days ago. During that time, there was an intense debate in the media, or multiple hundreds of intense debates in the media, in the radio, in universities, about, you know, the risks of some of the provisions adopted by the assembly. There was, for example, a controversy about the right to housing, which some people argued, in my view, I think, completely incorrectly, and probably they knew that this was not a proper interpretation of the constitutional text. But the fact is that the constitution said something like everyone has a right to housing, but didn't mention that right to housing would be realized through the right of property. That is to say, the constitution didn't protect the right to housing, by giving everyone or guaranteeing that everyone would own their own house. And of course, that's something totally reasonable. You know, what you protect is the right to housing. That doesn't mean that the right to housing needs to be realized by a particular form of ownership over the house, and that is guaranteed by the state. But the debate then became about whether, you know, the opponents of the Constitution would say, actually, the Constitution doesn't protect the right, people's right to property over their own house. In fact, if the Constitution is adopted, you may lose your house because the Constitution doesn't protect the right to property over your house. That was not true, but this was what was said constantly. And then defenders of the Constitution were constantly on the defensive. They were explaining, not actually, that's not what the Constitution says. And I think that created a lot of confusion among the electorate. So perhaps that's one of the reasons. I mean, at least that's one factor. Another factor, I know that I have taken a bit of time with this answer, but it's a very complex question. Another thing that may have influenced the result is that for the first time in many years, the vote was mandatory. And if you didn't go to vote, you would be fined. And that resulted in a very high percentage of participation in the plebiscite. But it may have meant that people who were just generally hostile to politics, generally hostile to the government, they were required to vote and they voted against the Constitution. The other topic that is quite relevant for New Zealand that created a lot of controversy here was the recognition of legal pluralism, which was recognized in the constitutional text, and the recognition of Chile as a plurinational state, that is to say, a state comprised of many different nations. And to some people, that was contrary to the notion of Chile as a single state comprised of people who are Chileans. We may have different cultures, but are all part of a single nation. So that was another thing that I think that created, at least for some people, it was they saw quite as, you know, as a sort of risky approach, in the sense that they thought it could be then lead to certain indigenous groups, for example, wanting to secede from Chile, even though the Constitution actually says that secession is prohibited, but still the debate took place in this way, where a combination of misinformation and also sort of extravagant interpretations of the Constitution that in a way created a lot of confusion.
And so what now? How does work begin on creating a new constitution that Chileans will approve?
Yes, well, one thing to take into account is that at the very beginning of the process formally started with a referendum that asked Chileans whether they wanted a new constitution. And over 80% of the electors who participated in the referendum voted yes. So I think that the consensus right now in Chile, from what I've seen in the news and from talking to people, is that it is clear that Chileans want a new constitution, that they have, that there's a majority of people in Chile that think that the constitution of 1980 should be replaced, that for some reason that no one really understands, we mentioned some of the possible factors before, Chileans didn't think that this project that was presented was a good one, but that they still want a new constitution. And then the question that is being discussed now is, what should be the process through adopt that new constitution, which will be, of course, different from the one that was just rejected. And there are talks about having a second constitutional convention, and a constitutional convention in Chile is the name of the constitution making body. Some other people say, so maybe what we could do is to have a commission of experts that drafts a new constitution, or perhaps revises the draft that was rejected, and then that new draft is submitted to referendum. But the truth is that there's no, you know, no one knows exactly what will happen, but there seems to be a general agreement that the constitution-making process hasn't ended, that it will continue until a new constitution is produced.
That was Vic University law professor Joel Colon Rios chatting to me from Santiago about the legal aspects of Chile's constitutional reform.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.